This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The best way to save our public programs such as Medicare and Medicaid is to have a national single-payer healthcare program and improve Medicare for All without profit that will cover everyone.
Medical professionals are organizing for a national day of action for single-payer healthcare for all.
We are in the midst of a national emergency. And so we are saying Mayday, 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 because we know that billionaires scheme their way into our government. They hoard wealth, they exploit working people, and slash jobs and resources in the process.
More than 2,000 union and community organizers from 155 cities are mobilizing for a historic Mayday 2025, as over 60,000 AFSCME and CWA UPD workers prepare to strike.
Everybody has an agenda around Congo, but nobody has a justice agenda for Congo. So it seems to be one essential tool to be used in order to end those atrocities.
Activist groups call for an international court to prosecute crimes committed during the 30-year war and conflict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
So it's been going on for decades, this research. It's still going on. And in my opinion, it needs to be stopped.
Strong evidence points to the laboratory origin of the current H5N1 bird flu outbreak, specifically the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Southeast Poultry Research Laboratory in Athens, Georgia. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Millions of working people risk losing their Medicaid coverage under sweeping budget cuts proposed by the Trump administration. A push to privatize Medicare through the expansion of Medicare Advantage plans is also underway. Dr. Anna Malino, former president of Physicians for National Healthcare, spoke to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
My name is Anna Malino. I'm a retired pediatrician, and I am one of the lead organizers for National Single Payer and for the movement to end privatization of Medicare. And we're here in front of the San Francisco General Hospital, the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, because this hospital takes care and provides health care for many, many people here in San Francisco who are covered by Medicaid. Medicaid is under threat of being cut, and so of course the people who get health care here are threatened with loss of their health care coverage. But of course, the threat of losing their health care coverage started way before the Trump administration. It happened actually at the end of the public health emergency, so-called, when the unwinding of the continuous enrollment of Medicaid was put into effect. And as a result, 25 million people in this country lost Medicaid. I believe it was close to about 2 million or so here in California lost their Medicaid coverage. So this threat of Medicaid being cut has been around for a long time. As a matter of fact, it's a means-tested program. And so people on Medicaid are threatened with a loss of their healthcare coverage month after month after month after month. And while it's perfectly natural to go on the defensive when public programs such as Medicare and Medicaid are being attacked, more important at this point is to go on the offensive. And the best way to save our public programs such as Medicare and Medicaid is to have a national single-payer healthcare program and improved Medicare for All without profit that will cover everyone, everybody in and nobody out. And that's why we're here. We're here to talk about the National Day of Action, which is going to occur on May 31st. Here in San Francisco, we're planning to gather at 11 a.m. at the Harry Bridges Plaza in the Embarcadero, and then march from the Embarcadero to BlackRock on Howard Street. And why BlackRock? Well, because BlackRock is the world's largest asset manager, having assets of over $7 or $8 trillion. And they are also the second largest shareholder of United Healthcare. And we know that United Healthcare is the country's largest insurance company. They're also the country's largest denier of claims, using AI that is 90% 100% error-prone, and also the largest upcoder of claims, so that they scam Medicare up to $3.7 billion every year. So that's why we are going to BlackRock. That's why we are protesting UnitedHealthcare, because the demand of the National Day of Action is to put single payer on the nation's agenda and to remove profit from healthcare. In fact, I'd like to read the four demands of the National Day of Action on May 31st, which is actually happening across the country, not just San Francisco, but across the country. Over 65 organizations have endorsed the National Day of Action. Many of them are planning actions in their own cities. And if you're interested to find out if there's an action going on in a city near you, because they're also happening in other places in California and all across the country, you can go to our website, and I hope I can plug it, www.nationalsinglepayer.com, and then you can scroll down to the map and see if your city is there. At any rate, our demands for the National Day of Action on May 31 are the recognition by our government that healthcare is a human right, the elimination of private health insurance and the banning of for-profit delivery of care, the enactment of a publicly financed national single-payer program that would provide comprehensive coverage to everyone, and the transformation of healthcare delivery from profit-seeking ventures into services organized to serve the people of our country, the ones who are paying for this healthcare, a system in which all caregivers are freed from corporate profit and corporate control. So those are our demands.
So maybe you can talk, there's been a drive to privatize healthcare in the United States with Medicare Advantage. Maybe you can talk about the history of that. And also, recently, one of the things Trump administration has done is to increase payments to these privatizers like UnitedHealthcare, $34 billion. So while they're cutting services and care to working people and people who need healthcare, they're giving billions more to these privatizers.
Exactly. So let's take Medicare first, and then we'll move on to Medicaid. Both programs are heavily privatized, meaning that healthcare is now being managed for beneficiaries by for-profit seeking health insurance companies. So for Medicare, over 50% of Medicare enrollees are now in Medicare Advantage. And as I mentioned before, Medicare Advantage is run by profit-seeking insurance companies that deny care, upcode, and then make billions and billions of dollars for themselves. So more than half of Medicare is already privatized. Actually, 75% of Medicaid is privatized as well, because 75% of the people on Medicaid are managed through Medicaid Managed Care Organizations, also known as MCOs. And in fact, they're even worse than Medicare Advantage, if you can believe that, because they deny claims at twice the rate of Medicare Advantage rate. So Medicaid is more privatized than Medicare Advantage, and Medicare Advantage is already more than halfway privatized. Now, a secret that a lot of people don't know is that even if you're on traditional Medicare, you are at risk of being aligned by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services without your knowledge or consent into one of these profit-seeking accountable care organizations. And they're going to deny your care and restrict your networks as much as any Medicare Advantage plan, except you're paying more for traditional Medicare than you would for Medicare Advantage. So yes, everything is being privatized, and you're absolutely right. I think it was April 7th, the Trump administration announced through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that they were going to up the Medicare Advantage rates by over 5%. Biden had said that his administration would increase it by 2.2%, which is more than, it was bad enough, but now Trump, yes, is giving billions of dollars more to Medicare Advantage. Like, it's giving them a raise when we know that they're just totally ripping us off, and yet we're going to give them a raise starting in 2026. So interestingly, that seemed to coincide with Trump's announcement about the tariffs, which took Wall Street into a tailspin, except for the private health insurance industry, because they made billions and billions and increase their profits. And they rallied, their stock soared because of the announcement by the Trump administration.
They've been allowed, and who has pushed Medicare Advantage? Because as you've discussed, Medicare Advantage is really a detriment to working people, and it's ripping off United Healthcare. I mean, Luigi Mangione targeted the executive, but why would the unions be supporting it in this country, advertising it and suggesting that workers subscribe to the Medicare Advantage programs?
It all has to do with money, and that's why we are protesting on May 31st, because what we need to do is get money and profit out of healthcare. So this is what happens. Why are you asking, why is Congress supporting Medicare Advantage? The vast majority of people in Congress do support Medicare Advantage, and that's because these insurance companies contribute to their campaigns, increasing their campaign contributions and outright buying these politicians who then write the laws and write the rules for to increase the revenues and profits of the insurance industry, which increases their profits, which means that they have more money to spend on future politicians to buy them off, to write the rules in their own favor. And so that's the negative feedback loop that we must stop. And that's why on May 31st, we are calling for a National Day of Action to remove profit from healthcare and to put single payer on the nation's agenda.
And maybe you can talk about institutions like San Francisco General, because a lot of public hospitals are able to continue going because of Medicaid. If Medicaid is shut down, what does that mean for public health care in this country?
Well, yes, public hospitals like San Francisco General do depend on public funds, on state funds, on local funds, on federal funds. And if these dry up, then the people who are getting the services, of course, are going to suffer. And then the people who work here are also going to suffer as well. The problem with the healthcare system that we have, it is a patchwork system of, you know, we're going to provide healthcare for the poor. Even though we're the richest nation on earth, we have a special program to provide healthcare for the poor. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. And then we have another special program that if you make it to 65, we're going to provide healthcare for those of you there, but we're going to privatize it so that instead of money going to pay for your healthcare, it's going to pay for the bottom, you know, line of these super rich corporations. So what we need is to have a system where public hospitals, such as San Francisco General Hospital, can provide healthcare for the people of this city and county without having to worry about where their next penny is going to come from, without having to worry about, will we be able to afford to pay our workers? Will we be able to afford these services? What we need is one people, one plan. We all need to be under the same system so that you don't have to qualify for Medicaid month after month after month in order to be able to get the services here. Anybody should be able to come here. Anybody should be able to choose the doctor or the hospital of their choice. We need to have redistribution of our resources so that the poor hospitals or the hospitals that are serving poor people have the resources that they need in order to serve the people, not because they are poor, but because they deserve health care.
That was Dr. Anna Malino, who is part of an effort to organize a National Day of Action for single-payer health care for all. She spoke to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. Last week, more than 2,000 union members and working class activists came together in a national planning meeting for May Day 2025, organized by the grassroots coalition May Day Strong. Participants joined from over 155 cities across the U.S., signaling a powerful groundswell of labor and immigrant solidarity in the lead up to International Workers' Day. Over 60,000 workers from ASME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and UPTE, University Professionals and Technical Employees, affiliated with CWA, the Communication Workers of America, will be walking off the job on May 1st. Rico Campo of a national immigrant rights network highlighted the central role of undocumented workers in the struggle, while AFSCME 3299 Executive Director Liz Perlman outlined growing support from unions like the National Education Association.
My name is Rico. I am here on behalf of several coalitions representing over 30 immigrant rights organizations, from FIRM to the Immigration Justice Situation Room. We are a coalition of immigrant rights organizations that fight for the dignity and respect of people. I come as one, but I stand as 10,000. I'm also here for Mahmoud Khalil. I'm also here for Rumeysa Osturk, the PhD student that was picked up from Tufts University. I'm also here for Gilmar Abrego Garcia. And I'm here with this message. We are in the midst of a national emergency. And like any aircraft that is in an emergency, they will signal the words, Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. And that is the signal that we, not only as an immigrant community, undocumented community, but our neighbors who are struggling with rent, our neighbors who are getting priced out of the housing market, our union brothers and sisters and siblings who are not being appreciated for the work that they do and being locked out of their contract. We are in the midst of a national emergency. And so we are saying Mayday, 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 because we know that billionaires scheme their way into our government. They hoard wealth, they exploit working people and slash jobs and resources in the process. And we know that working people across the country are coming together in the face of a national crisis to declare one struggle, one fight, all workers unite. And we know that working people in this country keep this country running. And that's why on May 1st, people like me and my community, who call this place home, are organizing hundreds and hundreds of marches across the country to recognize the humanity of undocumented folks, immigrant folks, to recognize the humanity of those who have lived in this country, that have called this country home, but yet this country does not recognize it. I represent a coalition of immigrant rights organizations that is asking for your support, to provide support to immigrants in this country that are terrified, are scared to go out of their home right now because they fear they might get picked up, like the names that I just mentioned. We have a map of the marches that we have happening and the actions and protests that we are organizing that is coming live on Monday. And in this link, we are asking for folks to help us come and participate in an action.
Hi, everybody. My name's Liz Perlman, and I'm ready to shut it down. As like we are coming together across every single sector. And we can just say that it's just this time that they attacked us, but they've been attacking us, okay? And that's exactly how our members feel. We have immigrant workers, women, black, brown, from all around the globe. And every one of our members is sick and tired of getting treated like dirt, okay? And that is why 100% they are striking. All of our members are going on strike on May Day, May 1st. They're going to be joining their siblings in another union up DCWA. We're going to be shutting down the entire University of California system because they cannot do their business without us, okay? And what does it mean to do their business? Their business, whether it's at higher education institutions in California or across the country, is making money, right? And we've just been told that, you know what? You people, your custodians, your cooks, you gotta do more with less. Now you gotta do the jobs of three people, of four people. We have people living in their cars today, sleeping in their cars, working at the number one public research university in the globe. And they're being told, no, we've got a hiring freeze because instead of, you know, maybe selling some buildings or, you know, taking a pay cut ourselves and making millions of dollars as the CEOs and chancellors of these systems, in order to fight back Trump, you know what you have to do? You have to tighten your belt. You have to do more work with less. And it's not only is it illegal, right? Who's heard of an employer breaking the law? Shocking, right? But it is fundamentally undemocratic. It is trying to silence workers, and our people are sick and tired. They are ready to show up and show out, and we hope that you join us. We hope that you join any May Day action. We're gonna be on every single UC campus and medical center on May Day. Come down, and then we're joining the May Day marches everywhere in California. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, we know that all these folks are in cahoots together. You know, just as a side note, our members' pension money, right? Like worker money right now is being used to make Blackstone, the biggest landlord in the country, even richer, right? So that they can turn around and raise rents on our members, right? These are the same companies that Elon Musk is profiting from, that Donald Trump is profiting from. And these are the folks, this is our money. And these are not, you know, the typical billionaire bad guys. The good news is the billionaires are coming out. But these are university officials, right? These are the guys who say, oh, we all have to be on the same side now. No, we're sick and tired of that. And we've been fighting the corporate class that's running our university system. University workers are sick and tired of it. We're ready to shut it down.
Those were the voices of migrant worker Rico Campo and University of California AFSCME 3299 Executive Director Liz Perlman, talking about plans for May Day 2025. More information about national organizing is available at support@maydaystrong.org.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find.
That was Paul Robeson, Joe Hill. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The Congolese Action Youth Platform, Dr. Dennis Mukwege, and the Case for the Land have called for an international court to prosecute crimes committed during the 30-year war and conflict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. During that time, Rwanda and Uganda have repeatedly invaded and occupied DRC, massacred Congolese people and Rwandan refugees, looted the country's resources, and waged wars that led to the overthrow of two Congolese governments. I spoke to Benedicta Njoko of the Case for the Land. Benedicta, what is the thinking behind the call for an international regional court to prosecute crimes committed in Congo?
Well, looking at the conflict in the Congo that has been lasting now nearly for 30 years, it seems to us important to really put the question of justice into the conversation. Because if we want to end impunity for war crimes and atrocities, if we want to provide justice to the people and through that mechanism stop the war, it seemed really essential for us to call for that, for justice, to call for an institution that will try just to give justice to the people, because after 30 years of war and the millions of deaths in Congo, it seems that nothing really can stop this event from going. Everybody has an agenda around Congo, but nobody has a justice agenda for Congo. So it seems to be one essential tool to be used in order to end those atrocities.
There's only been one regional court, the Court for Sierra Leone, which has resulted in justice and reconciliation. And the other regional courts, the International Criminal Tribunal on Yugoslavia and the International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda, which has a lot to do with crimes in Congo, have been agendized to create a Western narrative in Yugoslavia to justify NATO bombing and the Balkanization of Yugoslavia, and in Rwanda to create a narrative that served Western purpose. It began with judicial notice, meaning assumptions that didn't have to be proven, that there was a Tutsi genocide in Rwanda, that the Hutu were guilty, was based on Tutsi victimhood and Hutu guilt. And then this assumption that was reinforced throughout the existence of the court was then moved into Congo, where Rwanda's constant argument for its presence was that it was preventing another Tutsi genocide. How do you think that a Congo court can address that and can be not politically agendized? If it's created by the UN Security Council, as international regional courts are, how can it be a court that doesn't serve the Western narrative?
Yeah, well, it is true, looking at what happened for Rwanda, that it looks like this tribunal has been established in the name of justice, but it functioned in many ways as an imperialist tool. It also reflected, I think, the power dynamics of a global system where Africans or African sovereignty is subordinated to Western political interests. And of course, it should raise question. But I think that this is a fair critique to make, but we need also to propose something that should be constructive, a way and ways to resist and rebuild justice from maybe the ground up. I think that one or maybe of the way of doing that, avoiding that imperialist narrative on those tribunal, is maybe to try first to strengthen local and regional justice systems, because we know that for Congo, it is difficult because the country is in such a mess and the government is not functioning very well. And it is important that we find ways in Congo to try to strengthen those local institution and justice system that is in place. There was a case, and I don't remember exactly what year it was, but we had a military court in Congo that issued a judgment that condemned some armed groups of genocide. So meaning this shows that some instances where they are not directly linked to the desires or agendas of the government can also serve justice to the people. So I think this is an encouragement for us to think maybe outside the box in terms of this judicial system. And I think also what would be the requirement for us in order to avoid our sovereignty to be undermined by Western interests is also to demand something like equal representation in global justice. If we are to engage with international court, I think it is important we ensure that African voices are not marginalized, because this is what has been the case. I mean, we see judges of the International Criminal Court being, of course, not Westerners. But still, I think that we really need to insist on those kind of things to have African voices there, and they need to be central. And this means judges, prosecutors, and the legal experts from the continent must be at the table. And this should not be done as a token, but as decision makers. And as long as the international justice is in a certain way steered by those who were silent or complicit here, in this case, in the Congo, in the crimes, it cannot be trusted, of course. So we really need to push on those kinds of solution. And we need to also expose and resist the double standard, because if we want to have true justice, we need to raise those questions, because no justice system can be credible if it selectively prosecutes the losers here of war and really turn a blind eye on crimes committed by some other parties. So we really need to create a force that will really challenge those double standards and expose them as well, in order also to put pressure on those tribunals. And again, I also think that we need really to invest in African legal structures in order to build an independent and maybe African-led legal system in order to resist those opinions, because what is normally what transpires from those courts, for me, sometimes is more about opinions, the way people are thinking certain things and not relying on facts. So we need to have that African-led legal system. It needs to be empowered in order really to force those courts to do the right things. And this means that we need to expand maybe the African Court on Human and People Rights. And we need to train a new generation of lawyers who understand both the West and also Africa, all that international realities and African realities. This will be, I think, something very important. And lastly, I think, and that's why a court is made for, is really to center on the victims and all the victims. And that's why I think a document like the mapping report is important, because it gives voices to all the victims. This is not just about prosecuting the Hutus, it's not just about prosecuting the Congolese or the Tutsis, but it talks about all the victims that are lost their lives in that region for the last three decades.
Okay, I want to talk about the African Court. First, a couple more things about the problems of the international Western-created courts, including the ICC. The ICC has said it will start prosecuting individuals in Congo, and it already did that once when it prosecuted and convicted Bosco Ntaganda, and the court was planning to try him as a Rwandese. But he stood up in court and said that he was Congolese. They simply accepted that. They prosecuted him and convicted him as Congolese. What's wrong with that?
Again, this is what I'm saying. If we don't have a legal system that is very much aware of the realities of our countries, our continent, people who are not very well trained on those realities, this is what happens. And again, it serves the imperialist or Western narratives, because I think that the long effort that has been made in that region, as per the narrative that had to be accepted by everybody, is that Congo is a civil war. It's not. It doesn't suffer from external aggression, but these are internal problems. And again, for me, these are opinions. People seem not really to be well educated or don't want to educate themselves in the realities of that region because they serve certain interests. So that's why I think they accepted that without challenging what he was saying with facts. And I think that if we look at all the reports that have been issued by the Security Council around that conflict, what was happening, I mean, in some of them, when you look at what they said about, for instance, the new leader of the M23, Sultani Makenga, they have the proofs. They have communications through messages that were sent. They know how they smuggle minerals and how they use boats in order to go to Rwanda. So they know all those things. But if they are not challenged on that, if people are not willing to be educated and defend justice, really, for the people, of course it will be accepted. And of course, they will actually buy what those people like Bosco Ntaganda are saying. And it serves, again, the interests of the winners.
Well, trying him as a Congolese seemed to shield Rwanda from responsibility.
Of course it is. And this is part of what I was saying, is this is the justice of the victors. Because I don't think, I mean, Rwanda has been such an asset in that region, meaning that it operated for the American interests. And now we see, for instance, how France, for instance, is willing really to protect Rwanda because it uses Rwanda in Mozambique, you know, to protect Toto and so forth, even though now they want to step back. I mean, it's really an asset. And they are not ready to get rid of that asset. So, of course, they'll do the most possible in order to protect Rwanda. And as I'm saying, to try to portray what is happening in the Congo as an internal problem. And if there is war, it's a civil war. It has nothing to do with Rwanda. And this has been the position of Rwanda, saying that this is an internal problem, is a Congolese problem. And buying what Bosco Ntaganda says is really actually comforting that idea for me.
Right. There are also international actors, including multinational corporations and arms dealers, the high-tech weapons introduced into the region, particularly those used by Rwanda, which greatly exceed the technical capability of DRC, of the Congolese army, come from elsewhere. They're not manufactured in Africa. And it's documented that representatives of multinational corporations have arrived in DRC and dealt directly with warlords. These people are not going to be prosecuted at the ICC.
Yes, exactly. But as a people, we cannot be defeated by that. And what I mean is that we need, and maybe this is something some people are going to say we are delusional, but I think that anyway, we need to push forward. We really need, as I was saying, expose and resist all those narratives, all those acts, and put that to the fore in order to have justice served. So if we just, you know, look at the situation saying, okay, those people are not going to be prosecuted, what I believe, and this is maybe our job as a people, is that we can still maybe change the balance. Maybe if in Congo we have somebody else as Felix Tshisekedi and somebody who is really willing to put the question of justice at the center on the table, we can even have our own tribunal, you know, saying here that those people have committed crimes. Maybe we are not going to be able to prosecute them because this is an international matter, but still, at least we will say something about what is happening in the Congo. And for me, it starts there because there are too many lies. People are deceived. And it's important we have that voice saying, this is what happened in these countries. This is what those people have been doing. And this needs to really comes from the Congo. If it doesn't, then, of course, I mean, it will go on and on. But it's really important for us to really keep on pushing and call for justice and also work on another hand to have representatives that are really capable of defending the Congo and willing to talk about justice. Otherwise, of course, it will be difficult. But we need to anyway, we need to push forward.
Yeah, there's no court that would have jurisdiction to do that. The International Criminal Court is only empowered to prosecute individuals and possibly in the International Court of Justice. but it's still hugely unlikely that these international actors, including Western multinational corporations, will be indicted or prosecuted. So let's go on to the prospect for an African court. Congo has sued Rwanda in the African Court of Human and People's Rights. And here's, let me read the paragraph that Congo's lawyer said to the court at the outset. He said, "Today, the African Court on Human Rights is opening the trial against Paul Kagame's Rwanda, which is slaughtering people in Congo, plundering our wealth, and even raping babies. And these acts have already caused more than 13 million deaths and 6.3 million internally displaced persons, meaning people driven from their villages to exploit Congo's resources." And he said that this was confirmed in United Nations reports. So what do you think of the prospect for this African court in dealing with this issue?
I think, again, that we need to work with what is available and try also to invest in, as I was saying before, in African legal infrastructure in order to have that African voice be heard. Because I think the problem that we have, and most of the time, and of course, it is normal that we talk to the Westerners because they are involved in the Congo. But we also neglected a little bit what the continent could do. And I think that the Africa that we're seeing today, when you look at what is happening in the Sahel with Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, you see that there is now a shift, that there is something happening. And if you listen to African youth now, these are people who are not willing to be told what they need to do. This is a youth that aspire to be really independent, to fight for their sovereignty. So there is another narrative on that continent. And I think that if we keep on pushing into that direction, and if we invest in African legal infrastructure, if we try to train a new generation of lawyers who understand those realities, I think that maybe we can achieve something. And to tell ourselves in a certain way that we don't need the international community to tell us, okay, this is the wrong that has been done to you, if they are not willing to do that. And now, even if it went wrong at the end, I always think about Guatemala and all the things that happened in Guatemala with Rios Montt. And after that, I mean, you had judges in Guatemala who said that what has been done to the indigenous people was a genocide. Of course, this ruling was then revoked because the president was also involved in those crimes that were committed there. But this is a country that shows at a certain point that, okay, you know what? You are not willing to say what happened in our country, but we are going to say it nevertheless. And I think this is a way to empower people. And we need to take examples of those countries as well and really, really be confident of the fact that once we have legal systems on that continent that talk about those kind of tragedies that happen on that continent, there is something that is going to change.
That was Benedicta Joko on the need for justice in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Freedom Studio. This is for my friends who live with me in my country, Congo. Freedom, my dream. Idengo. Sio muda ya kuenda kanisani kwenda kumuomba Mungu wa Israeli. Sio muda ya kuenda muskitini kwenda kuchubua mwili yako bure. Sio muda ya kuenda hotelini kwenda kufanya malaya. Sio muda ya kuenda bao kwenda kulewa. Wametuvamia ngambo na ngambo, shambani ya tuwendi mtini tuachukiana. Wameshika mateka serikali, askari jeshi wote wamegeuka manduyo. Wametuvamia ngambo na ngambo, shambani ya tuwendi mtini tuachukiana. Wameshika mateka serikali, askari jeshi wote wamegeuka manduyo.
That was Delcat Idengo Divize, 2024 Beni DRC. Idengo was assassinated in February. Rwanda's M23 and the Congolese government each blame the other for his death. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. In January, epidemiologist Nicholas Hulscher spoke to Mike Vera of the Healthy and Awake podcast about the growing evidence of the laboratory origin of the current H5N1 bird flu virus. Mr. Hulscher discusses the paper he co-authored titled Proximal Origin of Epidemic Highly Pathogenic Avian Influenza Spread by Migratory Waterfowl, which was published November 2024 after successful peer review in the Journal of Poultry, Fisheries, and Wildlife Science.
What we found was actually pretty shocking. So in Athens, Georgia, at the USDA Poultry Research Laboratory, we found on their website, they actually admit to it on a webpage that they're conducting H5NX gain-of-function serial passage research in this lab. And what that means is, so they've been taking H5N1 or N2, because they put an X at the end of it. They didn't want to tell everybody exactly what they're doing. So what they've done, they've taken that virus and they just put it in the ducks, mallard ducks, over and over and over and over and over again until the virus becomes more transmissible or more deadly. And so it's a great question as to why they need to conduct this research. It's absolutely reckless. And what we found was, so they've been doing that, and then all of a sudden, 2021, when this started, and it was also the same year when the new H5N1 clad 2344B first was detected in the United States. Well, we found that a particular strain, genotype B11 and B12, were detected in Georgia, the same state where this lab was, about a few months after this gain of function started. And so that was there. And then a few months after that, there was the same exact strain, genotype B12, was found in a dolphin off the coast of Florida. This dolphin was washed up or it was stuck somewhere. So they picked up this dolphin. They wonder why it died. They opened up the dolphin, performed a necropsy, and they performed a genetic analysis to see, well, what happened? Why are all the organs destroyed? What's with all this necrosis going on in the dolphin's brain? And they found this H5N1 strain. So it just jumped species, traveled likely through migratory waterfowl, gotten in sea life. It's strange it even infected sea life to begin with, but it did. And then a year or two after that, all of a sudden it shows up in all these cows. It shows up in various animal species, actually probably over 50 animal species now they're finding this in. So it's been an absolute disaster. What we believe has happened is that this did leak out of this Southeast Poultry Research Laboratory via either animal escape or a worker had it on their clothing and walked out. They didn't know it or something along those lines. And it's resulted in where we're at now, with now 61 human cases as of today, and California declaring a state of emergency, which is, I believe, a massive overstep that's going to result in disastrous consequences. And now we're at this moment, likely as a result of these reckless gain-of-function experiments.
Obviously, when it came to COVID, they were trying to tell us it was bat soup. And it sounds like with what you're saying here, specifically with bird flu, that it's not some kind of new flavor of soup, that it's actually manufactured.
Right, right. And yeah, nobody ate bat soup. Nobody ate a dolphin. Nobody ate a cow that had it. They're playing with these in laboratories. And we saw even a few weeks ago, it's not just the Southeast Poultry Research Lab. No, it's been going on in other places, and I'll give you three examples. We'll start with the most recent one. So in the Scripps Institute in California, This lab, this bio lab, is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as you might expect. And it's also funded by the NIH. And so what they've done is they look to see if the current bird flu strain, which mutations would be required to better infect humans, to change the specificity from avian receptors to human receptors. And they found exactly the amino acid they needed to change. And they shared it in the journal Science for the entire world to read, basically giving the blueprints for bioterrorism if they want to make this virus transmit among humans efficiently. So that's what they've been doing there in California, which is extremely dangerous. They should not be publishing this research. It's just not worth the risks. And so they did that. But Yoshihiro Kawaoka in the University of Wisconsin-Madison, over in Wisconsin, he's been for decades doing bird flu gain-of-function research. He's been also trying to change the specificity to better infect humans. And he, in his laboratory, has had multiple lab accidents. And this is outlined in our paper. He had puncture wounds. People walked out with it. They got infected. They had to quarantine them. And these are with modified strains. So that's been a disaster. And then we go all the way to the Netherlands at the Erasmus Medical Center with Ron Fouché. He's also been modifying bird flu viruses to become actually airborne transmissible. So he's been looking out how to do this. And he's been using ferrets due to their similarities in some aspects to humans. So he's been doing that. And so it's been going on for decades, this research. It's still going on. And in my opinion, it needs to be stopped as soon as possible before another leak happens or before more of these blueprints are released for bad actors to copy. You know, the gain of function research needs to be put to a halt. It offers way more risks and very little benefit.
With what you're saying now, with these new examples that you're offering, I'm hearing that there actually have been multiple legitimate lab leaks from all kinds of different experimentation from different labs. So it sounds like it's kind of hard to know what exactly is really going on about how this got out.
Yeah, it's going to be almost impossible, if not impossible, to find out exactly what happened. As we see with the COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2 release from the laboratory in Wuhan, we're never going to be able to, you know, go back in time and see exactly what happened, but we can trace the footsteps. You know, we can look back, see any consistencies, any strange anomalies that might have happened. And we just got to put the pieces together, because quite frankly, the government's not going to do that for us. For sure, they're not going to. And nor are many of these major academic medical centers, any of the major research centers. They're all going to shy away from this. And we saw that when we were submitting our paper to major journals. They would just reject it without review. A lot of them, they wanted nothing to do with it. They still believe that the virus magically just came over from Europe in 2021 and the birds flew all the way across the ocean. And that's how they think it got here, which, you know, yeah, I guess in some cases, some strains could have got here. But that doesn't put away the fact that they have been getting shipments of these viruses, physical shipments into these bio labs and making them more dangerous. That's much more likely to be the case of why all of a sudden there was this massive host range leap, this massive evolution, accelerated evolution of this virus. It's very likely that this was not natural. This was laboratory driven.
That was epidemiologist Nicholas Huescher discussing the links between the current bird flu outbreak and secretive biolabs run by the U.S. government and pharmaceutical corporations. He notes on his focalpoints.org website that, quote, neither the USDA nor any other government agency has officially denied or refuted this possibility. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Seltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.